They were beginning here three lines down, on Nun Amud Aleph. We're beginning with the famous story of Rabbi Akiva and his wife. Parts of that story are found in the Gemara in Ketubot, the Gemara in Yevamot that we've seen. And here is the last piece of that story, a romantic side to the story, as well as the tremendous commitment of Rabbi Akiva's wife to his Limud HaTorah. It says that Rabbi Akiva, itkadash le brate de kalba savua. So the daughter of Kalba Sabua gets engaged halachically to Rabbi Akiva. Now, Kalba Sabua is one of the very wealthy individuals or families inside of Yerushalayim. The Gemara in Gittin tells us that it was one of the three major wealthy families in Yerushalayim at the time of the Churban HaBayit, and that those three families could have supported the entire Yerushalayim during the siege. In addition, they were very well known for their tremendous tzedakah, generosity, especially in Achnasat Orchim. The Gemara plays on the name Kalba Sabua to say that anybody who was as hungry as a dog would leave their house satisfied, so that they fed or took care of all those individuals who came to them as Aniim or Orchim. So now the daughter of Kalba Sabua gets engaged to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, we know, was a Roet Zon. He was a shepherd, and it was considered to be inappropriate that she married him, for a number of reasons, as we'll see later on. Shema Kalba Sabua. Sabua gets wind of this. Adra Hana'am Mikol Nechsei. Took a neder that restricted his daughter from getting any benefit from any of his possessions. Basically, disinheriting his daughter because of the actions that she took. Hazla V'insivo Le B'sidvo. She went ahead and she got married to him in the, call it the fall time, the winter time. Habuganu Be'tivna. Well, now that they were disinherited, Rabbi Akiva is a shepherd. He doesn't have anything, no money to his name. She has nothing to her name anymore. So they end up living in a straw shed together in order to shield themselves from the elements and to make their home. Rabbi Akiva was collecting or pulling out the straw from the hair of his wife. Amarla, have I had the means to do this, I would purchase for you a Yerushalayim shel zahav. Shalim Zel Zahav is mentioned in the Mishnah Yot in the Gemara and Shabbat with regards to a decorative type of headband made out of a gold that had the shape or the pictures of Yerushalayim on it that was worn on the forehead of the women. And it was a fancy piece of jewelry that was obviously coveted by women, and women who had it were very excited. So Rabbi Akiva is saying, because of the poverty that I'm in, I can't afford anything for you. So he's pulling out the straw from her hair, but he says had he had the means to, he would buy her this and treat her to this, which eventually at the end of this Gemara we'll see that he does become extremely wealthy, and he does, not in this Gemara, but in other places we know that he did buy his wife the Yerushalayim Shel Zahav as he intended. Hat Eliyahu Idami Luhon Ken Hasha. Eliyahu Navi appears to them like a human being, Bekakari Abavo, and he's knocking on the door. Amar Luhu. So they say, who's there? Come in. So he says to them, I believe Porta de Tivna. Says, can you please give me a little bit of straw? And that this person is extremely impoverished, has nothing to his name. Vigdilat itati. Veli midam laguna. My wife is giving birth or gave birth, and I have nothing to make bedding for her with or to give her a comfortable place. So could you spare some straw? So they obviously gave Eliyahu HaNavi the straw. Namarla Rabbi Akiva l'intatei. So Rabbi Akiva says to his wife, Chazi Gavra, Tafilu Tibna Lea, Itle. Do you see this individual that he doesn't even have straw? And as both Rashi and the Ran note over here, that Elovi did this, Mishum Korat Ruach Lehem, or Lenachemotam, to console them in their difficult position, that they were people that even poorer than them, that there was someone who was even in a worse position than they were, and that they could be generous, even though what they felt, their conditions were terrible. So Amarle, so now she says to Rabbi Akiva, Zilavi Beirav. Go and learn in the Beit Midrash. In the other Gemarot, it talks about the fact that the condition of their marriage was that he would go learn, and that he would become educated, become a Talmid Chacham. Azel, so he went ahead to the Beit Midrash. Avatarte Sarishnin, Kamed Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua. He went to learn for 12 years, by Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yoshua, who are the Rebbeim of Rabbi Akiva. The Mishlam Tarte Sarishnin, at the conclusion of those 12 years, Ka'ata Lebeite, he came back to home, he was returning home, and he overhears a conversation like this. Shama min achorei beitei. So here is from behind his house. The kamala achad rashol debeitu. That this terrible individual, this unkind individual was speaking to his wife. Shapir avid lechavuch. Your father was justified in what he did to you in disinheriting you. Chado delo domilech. First of all, you married someone who was inappropriate. Rashi says about the person himself, Rabbi Kiva, shu garua mimcha, that he was beneath you or he was not appropriate for you. The Ran plays on shein domilecha mimishpacha chashuvah kamotcha, plays on the yichus or the family standing, that it was inappropriate for her to marry a roetzon, a shepherd, a lowly person like that. It was inappropriate. And number two, va'od shvaka chamalut chayot kulun shtin. He's left you a living widow all these 12 years. So Amrele, so his wife, Rabbi Kiva's wife, Rachel, responds to this individual. Itzait lidili, if he listened to me, tarte sreishnin achranaita, he would stay for an additional 12 years. Amar, and Rabbi Kiva overhears this conversation, says, hov yavet li rishuta, since she gave me permission, ihadar achorai, I'm going back to the Beit Midrash. So Rabbi Kiva takes that as a green light to stay for an additional 12 years and returns to the Beit Midrash. Many of the Bali Musar talk about why didn't he just say hi to his wife and then return to the Beit Midrash. They speak about the power and the exponential nature of the consecutive learning or uninterrupted learning versus interrupted learning. That 12 plus 12 does not equal 24. So 24 years of continuous learning and building has an incremental effect versus the 12, and he said hi to his wife and then gone the other additional 12, that would have been less than the 24. That's number one. Number two is the fact that maybe if he had stayed back and then spent time with his wife and his family, who he was in touch with, but hadn't seen and spent time on a personal level for a long time, then he might not return to the Beit Midrash. So for any one of these reasons, Rabbi Kiva takes up his wife's permission, and maybe she might have changed her mind, and leaves and returns for another 12 years to the Beit Midrash. After the completion of that entire time, then it says, Hadar Azal Avatarte Shrei Shnin Achronaita, he went back to Beit Midrash for an additional 12 years. Ata Besrim Arba'a Alfin Zuge Talmidei. The end of the 24 years, he shows up with 24,000 pairs of Talmidim, 48,000 Talmidim. Obviously, there's a connection between the number of Talmidim and the years. Whether the numbers are exact or just they played like thousands of Talmidim, and each year was another thousand Talmidim, but a sense that he had accumulated a tremendous name in Torah, and that there were many Talmidim that were following him. Everybody went out to greet. Rabbi Kiva was returning to the city where his wife resided, and everybody went out to greet. They heard there's a Talmud Chacham coming to town, and everybody went out to greet him. And his wife as well went out to greet the Talmud Chacham coming to town. This terrible woman, unkind woman, says to Rabbi Kiva's wife, where are you going? Dressed like that? Where are you going? So Rabbi Kiva's wife's response is, Amrele, Yodei Tzadik Nevesh Bemto. The Tzadik knows the soul of his animal. Now, it's probably a play on the fact that Rabbi Kiva was a roetzon. That's a play on this word, Behemah. Yodei Tzadik Nevesh Bemto. It's unclear here, and Rashi notes this, as to whether she knew that the Talmud Chacham returning to town was Rabbi Kiva or another Talmud Chacham. And Rashi brings two interpretations, Ita Amrei Di Avat Yada, the Rabbi Kiva Aval, that she knew was Rabbi Kiva, and she's saying this about her husband, that her husband, she doesn't need to dress up for her husband, she doesn't have to put on any pretenses for her husband, because her husband knows who she is and what she's done for him. Then the other possibility says, Vita Amrei Di Avat Yada. She didn't know who was coming to town, which Talmud Chacham was coming. The tzaddik lo mevazen l'inshe. That tzaddikim don't demean people. They don't care about how they appear. They don't care about their dress. And I don't have to get dressed up specially for this Talmud Chacham. He'll accept me for what I am. Whether that means because of her impoverished state or because of the way that she was dressed. But she felt that the Talmud Chacham, even if she didn't know who it was, would not reject her because of the way that she appeared. Now the Gemara continues, Atat litchazuyele, she wanted to appear before him. Now whether this is, again, she knew this was Rabbi Akiva, or she didn't know it was Rabbi Akiva, she wanted to get in front of the Talmud Chacham, Ka matchan la rabbanan. So the Talmidim around Rabbi Akiva pushed her away, They didn't let her get her access to Rabbi Akiva. Obviously, there were many people trying to get access to Rabbi Akiva, and she was no different than anyone else. They pushed against her. Amar Lahon, Ani Chula Shali V'Shalachem Shalahu. One of the very famous lines by Rabbi Akiva. He says, let her be, let her approach me. Whatever I have and whatever you have, meaning his Talmidim, Shalahu, is from her. Both from the fact that she was the one who convinced Rabbi Akiva to go learn and pushed him to come become a Talmid Chacham, as well as the fact that she sacrificed so that he could go learn on a continuous basis over these last 24 years. That was all on her back, on her prodding as well as her sacrifice that's done. And here Rabbi Akiva gives full credit to his wife for the fact that they were successful, both him and his Talmidim. Shama Kalba Savua. So Kalba Savua here is about this Talmid Chacham coming to down. Atav Itchel Al Nidre. He went ahead to be mashal on the nether. Ishtirei Ishtiri. And Rabbi Akiva was matir the nether. Over here it's not clear that Kalba Savua again knows that the person who came to town was Rabbi Akiva. And he was specifically going because now he sees who Rabbi Akiva is. And he was going to tell him about the remorse he had overtaken this nether, or whether this was a Talmid Chacham coming to town and somehow else he had heard that Rabbi Akiva was doing well, he wanted to change his mind about this, and he wanted to be mashal of the nether, so he was going to the Talmid Chacham who was there at the time, and then that Talmid Chacham was being matir nether for him, and it turns out that it's Rabbi Akiva, which that is sounds like the story from other Gemarot, that he didn't know who it was, and then Rabbi Akiva identifies himself as being the Talmid Chacham. But either way, he goes and he asks to be matir the neder that he had taken to disinherit his daughter, to be osir her b'hana'ah, and Rabbi Akiva is matir the neder. Now the Iran raises, on the Amud Bet here, raises a serious issue with regards to being matir neder over here, and the difficulty with being matir neder. He says, how could he be matir the neder based on the fact that Rabbi Akiva was now a Talmud Chacham? That's something called nolad. Nolad means that his something new happened that was not available or information that was not available at the time that he took the neder. And now there's new circumstances or new information. And based on that new information, he wants to change his mind with regards to the neder. But we know that the haruchharata or the hatarat nedarim works on the fact that a person at the time of the neder, had he had this information, or if this information was available and he was aware of it, then he would have been taking a different approach and had a different thing in mind. But this isn't the case here because all the information became available to him at a much later time because Rabbi Akiva changes at a later time. And we know later on in the Masechta, the Ran quotes from the Mishnah, the Ein Potchei Minolad. Okay, so that an example they give is, Konam Shanina Enel Ish Ploni Minaseh Sofer, and then he becomes a person that's a Sofer, someone Chashuv, Amar. Eli Teyutei Ashi Aseh Sofer, Lo Hayti Noder. Had I known he would become a Sofer, I would not have taken this Neder. So his regret is because the person has changed, or the stature of the individual has changed. And we see that that's nolad, and that's not a reason to allow for Hatarat Nedarim. And basically our case is exactly that case. Kalba Savua's relationship towards Rabbi Akiva is changing because Rabbi Akiva changed. So the Ran says, Ishlamar, the Shani Hocha, the Rabbi Akiva dat, she assists Ofer Nas'a. Because this was a condition of the marriage. And we mentioned this before, that when he married her, she made as a condition of the marriage that he would go and learn and become a Talmud Chacham, and that he would apply himself to Limud HaTorah. And since it was a premise of the marriage, then it's not nolad, because the marriage wouldn't have existed unless Rabbi Akiva carried out this part of it. And therefore, it's something that did exist at that time. As well as the fact that Kalba Savua, in other places, says that had I known that Rabbi Akiva, in the Hatarat Nedarim, he says, had I known that this individual that she had married knew one halacha, one perek, even a small amount of Torah, I would never have taken the neder. He does not premise it on the fact that he's a huge Talmud Chacham, just simply on the fact that he's not a Roi Tzon. That Kalba Savua saw Rabbi Akiva as a Roi Tzon, a complete ignoramus, and therefore he took the neder. And he says, in his Hatarat Nedarim, had I known that he even known the smallest amount of Torah, even a perek achad halacha achad, that would have been sufficient for me not to take the neder. And that already is not something like he becomes a sofer, a Talmud Chacham. That's something that's manageable, something that can be done by anybody. And therefore, it wasn't something out of the realm of possibility or scope of reasonable outcomes that were there at the time that he took the neder. And that's why the Ran says that this is not classified as being nolad. Now the Gemara explains as an addendum to the story that Rabbi Akiva's life started out in tremendous poverty. because of, first of all, he was a Roed Son, but the woman that he marries is also disinherited by her father. But then that changes based on what we saw here in the Gemara. And now the Gemara says, Mishit Mile it Atar Rabbi Akiva. That Rabbi Akiva became wealthy from six things. In Kalba Sabua. One of them is the fact that once Kalba Sabua was Matir Neder, then Rabbi Akiva was a beneficiary of the wealth of Kalba Sabua, who gave then obviously inheritance to his daughter. And he, based on that, became much wealthier. But that's not the only reason. And some state the reason that the Gemara is bringing this over here is to show you that Rabbi Akiva did not become wealthy from his Limud Torah, did not become wealthy from his students or charging for teaching Torah, but his wealth came from other sources or outside sources. The next one is Min Ela Disfinta. It's from the Ayal, the deer that is on the top of the boat. The Chol Sfinta Avdinle Min Eina. That every boat they used to make some sort of ayin, we'll call it in a second. Zimna chada anshua kef yamo. One time they left this on the shoreline. Atahu, he came, ashkache, and found it. So now these were the, at the front of the boat, many times you can see this, that the boats in the front have a picture of an animal, a picture of some sort of god that is carved into the boat. Now, in terms of boats that were used for war or aggressive nature, those were made out of metal at the top and they were sharp and they were used to ram other boats. Where merchant boats had them there as a sign of good luck or as a charm. That's what it means, min eina over here, which is like the ayin atov or the ayin hara, something that was for good mazel that was put at the front of the boat. And you can see that by the boats that the Greeks put the Greek goddesses on the front of their boats. But it was a way to express their desire for good luck and that it would help them in their journey. Now, those were filled with gold coins or they were made out of expensive metals. Again, for the military boats, because of the need for it to be hard and be able to ram other boats. By the merchant boats, they did that, I would call it, quote unquote, as a sacrifice or as a way to placate the gods and hope that that would bring them good mazel. So they used to fill it with coins, or they used to make it out of a precious metal so that it would give them that good luck. So one time these sailors had one of these on their boat, and after they had taken care of whatever they were on the shoreline, they left, and they left it behind, and Rabbi Akiva found it. So the way our Gemara expresses it, it was an aveda, it was something lost, where Rabbi Akiva didn't know the balim, and he kept it, and it was full of gold, or it was full of coins, and he was enriched by that. There is an alternate to the story that's brought down, that Rabbi Akiva found it, and then returned it to the sailors. And they were so overwhelmed by the fact that he returned it, even though nobody would never ever do that because of the amount of wealth that was involved, that they granted him gifts or they gave him some of the money as a reward because of his tremendous honesty in returning this to them. Omin gamzo. And he also became wealthy from, Rashi calls it a chest over here, this gamzo. Others say that it was a board of sorts. Tzimna chado yoiv arba azuze lispunai. One time he gave four coins to these sailors or these business merchants. Said, please bring me back something that I could join in the business transaction with you and make some money off of this. They didn't find anything. They found this board or this chest that was left on the sides on the shoreline. They brought it to him. Amrule, they said to him, Avid Marana Ale. You should hang on to this. Marana meaning Mar, our master, you should hang on to this. Now, either they were giving it to him as like, this is all we could find, or they were telling him, you know, hold this as a placeholder and we'll find something better for you, but in the meantime, hold on to this. Ishtakas dava male didore, when he either opened the chest or he went to use the board that they had given him, found that it was filled with coins, and therefore he was then the beneficiary of this gift that they had given to him, or this business that they had brought him. In the end, turned out to be much better than anybody thought, and he was able to take it. I'm assuming if it was a chest, it seems a little strange that they hadn't opened it and seen inside that it was something great, but maybe based on the next story we'll see in the Gemara, maybe even if they knew about it, they gave it to Rabbi Akiva anyway. The Zimnachado Tavat Sfinoto, there was an instance where a boat capsized, and all the profits or the monies that were garnered by the merchants were stored either in this chest or in this board. And the boat went down with all their money. And this is what they found. This is what was on the shoreline that they brought back to him. Happened to be this thing that had stored within it all that wealth that was from these merchants. And it was found at that time from a group or a caravan of Ishmaelim that picked it up. And they sold it off to these individuals who then gave it to Rabbi Akiva. And then Rabbi Akiva was that the beneficiary of the fact that all that wealth that was stored in there, he was now the owner of that. And that's another thing that made him wealthy. Now, some people leave this out of the Girsa because the min sounds like this is one of the reasons that he became wealthy. But if you do that, then there's seven here and not six. And therefore, it's questionable whether this belongs in the Girsa or how this relates to the previous story. I gave you the explanation of the possibility of how it fit into the previous story. Another case is a case where a matron, one of the wealthy matrons of Rome, enriched Rabbi Akiva. Here the Rishonim bring down the story that Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim or the Yeshiva needed money, and he went to this woman and borrowed money, and she asked for collateral on that. And Rabbi Akiva said, what type of collateral would you like? And she said, I want God and the sea to be the guarantors of this loan. Rabbi Akiva fell ill at the time period when the loan was supposed to be repaid, and so he doesn't show up to repay the loan because of the fact that he was in failing health. So the woman goes out and says, listen, you know, you know that Rabbi Akiva was the one who promised me to pay back. He hasn't paid back, and you're the guarantor, as well as the sea is the guarantor of this loan. And what ends up happening is that the Bat Kisar, the daughter of the Caesar, has a ruach shtut, loses her mind, and takes a trunk full of precious jewels or silver and gold, throws them into the ocean, and that ocean carries that right to the feet of this woman, this matron, and basically repays her for the loan that Rabbi Akiva had taken out. Rabbi Akiva then recovers from his illness, and he travels to the woman to repay the monies that he had owed her. When he gets there, the woman tells him, you don't have to repay, the loan's already repaid, you can keep the money. Now, there are slightly different versions in the Rishonim about what exactly happened over here. You can see in Rashi, she tells him over at that time the whole incident that happened. V'natna lo matanot gedolot upartoto l'shalom. That she gives him many gifts and then sends him off on his way. So based on Rashi's explanation, he didn't keep the money that was given to repay the loans or that he raised to repay the loans, but rather she gifted him this based on the fact that she realized now that she had been the beneficiary of the guarantee of the loan being paid out to her. Plus, Rabbi Akiva's repaying her. So she granted gifts to Rabbi Akiva because Rabbi Akiva, in a sense, had enriched her. So she was granting Rabbi Akiva gifts. On the other hand, you can look in the Ran says, Va lecha mash natan li yoter, umaoto mamon shechzira lo nitashe Rabbi Akiva. The Ran says that the case was that she rejected the payment from Rabbi Akiva because she had already gotten repayment of the loan. And based on that, he kept the money that was supposed to go back to this woman, and that was a large sum of money that enriched him. Tosafot also has a slightly different version of the story, which notes that on that day when she is supposed to be repaid, that she actually knows that Rabbi Akiva is ill. And that's what she goes to a Kodesh Baruch Hu with. It says over here, Shegi Azman Chola Rabbi Akiva, Velo Ba, Halcha Sfat Hayam, she walked to the coastline, Am Rabbi Nun Shalom, Ayom Chola Rabbi Akiva, Abducha, Rabbi Akiva is ill, V'Amit Cha Reibli, and you are his guarantor, Ma'atzal Kodesh Baruch Hu, and then he continues with the story. So according to the Tosafot, the woman knew that Rabbi Akiva was ill and was not going to come to repay her. According to the other Rishonim, she didn't know that Rabbi Akiva was ill, and she's now calling on the guarantee because she's not being repaid. And then Rabbi Akiva, after he recovers from the ailment, goes to pay her off, and that leads to the remainder of the story. And then number five is Umin Ishto Shel Tunus Rufus, from the wife of Tunus Rufus. Tunus Rufus is the ruler of Yehuda at the time of the Hadrianic persecutions. He's one of those that actually put down the Bar Kokhba revolts and deals treacherously with Kalal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael at the time. And he is a enemy of the Jews and has many debates with Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara as well as the Midrash is replete with conversations between Rabbi Akiva and Tunus Rufus arguing about the philosophy of God and the nature of God in the world. The Gemara and the Yerushalmi actually notes that Tunus Rufus was the executioner of Rabbi Akiva in the story in Brachot, where the terrible killing of Rabbi Akiva at the hands of the Romans, that Tunus Rufus was actually the executioner of Rabbi Akiva. Based on the story here in the Darim, that would be impossible because Tunas Ruf was predeceases Rabbi Akiva in the story here, versus the story there where it's seemingly he's the executioner of Rabbi Akiva. It seems to be maybe a stira or a machlok between the Bavli and Yushalmi as to whether Rabbi Akiva outlives Tunas Rufus or Tunas Rufus outlives Rabbi Akiva, but they are arch rivals for sure. And because of that, the wife of Tunas Rufus here in the story sees her husband Tunas Rufus is despondent and asks why is he so down. He says, well, there's this guy Rabbi Akiva who I keep debating and he keeps winning the debates. I don't know how to get at him. And she says, please give me permission. I know that their God hates Znut or Zima, and let me go ahead and try to seduce Rabbi Akiva. So, it's just similar to the story that we find in the end of Parshat Balak, with regards to Bilam and his advice about how to entrap Bnei Yisrael. So over here, she tries to seduce Rabbi Akiva, and she comes and displays to him her tremendous beauty in an attempt to seduce Rabbi Akiva. And the story goes that Rabbi Akiva did three things at that time. He's Bacha, he cried, Sachak, he laughed, and Rakak, he spit. So now the wife of Tunas Rufus asks him, why did he do these three things? So according to most of the stories, it says, two things I'll tell you, the third one I will not tell you. And according to some of the Rishonim here, even the third one after she pressed him, according to Rashi, in the end he discloses her all three of the items. According to the Ran and the Tosafot, he only discloses two out of the three items, because the last one was something that, in the end, enriches him, but something that he didn't want to disclose her. It says that Rakak, because al shabat mi tipas rucha, because she's just a human being, she comes from a tipas rucha. The way that Tosafot interprets that means shat kutit. Tipas rucha means that you are a kutit upsula, and therefore you are pasul. Bacha, then he cried, because it's similar to the story of Rabbi Yochanan in the Gemara Brachot, says this type of beauty is going to end up in the ground being rima v'toleah. In the end, this is just something that's of a temporary nature, and such gorgeous and wonderful beauty is going to go then and be rot and dirt, and that you're going to return to the ground. So he cried about that, showing a tremendous appreciation for the beauty of this woman, and of course, Baruch Hu's creation of beauty in the world. But unfortunately, because it's Olam Hazeh, this is beauty that's ephemeral, it's not lasting, and therefore there's what to cry about because it's not something of permanence. Then Sahak, he laughed. So the Rishonim here say that he saw Beruach HaKodesh, that her husband was going to pass away, that she was going to convert, and then marry Rabbi Akiva. And sure enough, after the conversation, it seems like that he was not seduced by her. She's so impressed. She asks if there's anything she can do. Can she return? Can she do tshuva? And Rabbi Akiva answers in the affirmative. And she does tshuva. She converts. Her husband passes away, and she marries Rabbi Akiva. And all that tremendous wealth of Tunas Rufus is then brought over to Rabbi Akiva. Tiar Bar Shalom, as the Rishonim note over here, is a story in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Yud Amud Bet. There, the Roman emperor at the time decreed a terrible decree against the Jews. Tiar Bar Shalom, who had a soft spot for the Jews, went to their defense and actually is successful at defending the Jews and annulling the decree that the Caesar made. But because of his success, he is then sentenced to death, because if you trump the Caesar and you beat him in an argument, well, you are right, and therefore the decree is taken out, nevertheless, you are going to be punished. And he was punished with a death sentence. The story over there talks about how on his way to his death sentence, he gets a brit milah, and then he converts, and the bat kol comes out and says that he is muzman l'chayla maba. But at the moment when he's going to die or be put to death, he screams out that all of his possessions, his wealth, should go to Rabbi Akiva v'chaveirav. Rabbi Akiva and his chaveirim, and Rabbi Akiva their darshins, Aron uvanav. That means that 50% goes to Rabbi Akiva, 50% goes to everyone else. And so once again, Rabbi Akiva was enriched from Ketiar Bar Shalom. So from these six different incidences, Rabbi Akiva becomes extremely wealthy. So the poverty that he had was then changed into a tremendous wealth. But he was still Rabbi Akiva, and that's the main thing, or the main part of this main thing to take away from this story, is that Rabbi Akiva kept the Torah and was dedicated to the Torah both in poverty and in wealth, and neither of those changed his dedication to Liman HaTorah and his dedication to being an Oved Hashem. And just like he did it mitoch oni, as the Mishnah Avot says, then he was successful and he was able to do it mitoch osher, as the Mishnah Avot tells us that if one keeps the Torah and the mitzvot mitoch oni, then he will keep it mitoch osher. And he was able to reward his wife, who sacrificed so greatly on behalf of Rabbi Akiva, and she was, for many years, poverty-stricken and impoverished, he was able to reward her in the end with the tremendous luxury and the goods that she had. But the most important reward that he gave her was acknowledging her being the source for everything that he and his Talmidim had. And now we have another similar story to the story of Rabbi Akiva. And that's what I mentioned before about the trunk, that maybe even if they saw something inside of it, that they would have given it to Rabbi Akiva, because Rav Gamda, Yaiv Dalad Zuz El Supnai, he gave 4 zuz to these traders, these merchants, to pick him up something, to do some business with it, to make him some money. To bring something back. Lo Ashkochu, they couldn't find anything. At Yulei Bahom Kofa, they found a monkey of some sort that they brought back. That was all they could find for the money. So they brought it back for him. Ishtamet, the monkey ran away from them while they were bringing it back. Al Lecharto, it went inside of a hole. Chafru Badre, so they dug after it to go capture it again. Ashkahu Adarvia Al Margalaita, and they saw that he was crouching over this very precious stone, or precious stones or jewels, Aitunin Le Kulon. And they brought all that back to Rav Gamda. And as the Rishonim note over here, both in the Tosafot, it says, Midat Chasidut Asulo, that was Lifnim Ishur Tadin, that was inside the letter of the law, Lo Min Adin, they didn't have to do this, El Amru, Acharei Ashel Yado Begulgul Ba Natnulo. Because of him, we ended up at this place, therefore they felt it was only right to give it to him, because the only reason they had it is because he asked them to bring them something back. They bought the monkey, and the monkey led them to the jewels. So they felt that it really belonged to Rav Gamda. So out of their tremendous honesty and their feeling of gratitude that this is what took place, they gave it to Rav Gamda. I'm sure that Rav Gamda also rewarded them handsomely for helping him out, but this did enrich Rav Gamda. And the Rosh says the similar thing, that they acted here, Lifnim Mishurat Adin. Amrulei Bet Kesar the Rabbi Yoshua. So we've seen this story before in the Gemara in Tanit, that the daughter of the Caesar says to Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananyo, Torah Mifu'eret, Torah Mifu'ah, Bikli Mihuar. How is it that such the glorious Torah, the great Torah, is found in such a ugly, despicable utensil like yourself? The Rosh says over here that he's Mihuar Sheyashachor, that he had a darker or sunken complexion that made him look so terrible or ugly. But obviously he was not pleasant to look at. Amar La, he says, back to Limdimi Beit Avuch, I learned from your father's house. B'memanichim Yayin, in what do they place wine? Amar Le, B'manei de Bachro, they put them inside of clay utensils in order to store them. Amar La, he says, back to Kuli Alma B'Pachro, Batun B'manei de Bachro, everybody else puts them into these clay utensils, Kli Cheres, earthenware utensils, Batun B'manei de Bachro, and you keep the same thing? How can it be that the house of the king, of the emperor, uses the same utensils as everybody else? Atun, achitun, b'mani de kasva v'davo. Go ahead and put them into gold and silver. That's appropriate for the stature of the Caesar. Azlat, uramat, chamro, b'mani de kasva v'davo. She went ahead and put the wine into the silver and gold utensils. Visari. And it fermented. It turned into vinegar. Because that's the nature of wine, that if wine is kept in metallic utensils for a period of time, it causes a tremendous amount of oxidation of the wine, and it makes it go bad and turn it to vinegar, rather than to ferment at a slow pace, to turn it from the grape juice that it is into wine. Amala, alpha raita cane. Here the Gemara is a little shorter in the story. The Gemara in Tanit, Caesar calls him in and asks him why he made her do this and what was going on, and he explained the mashal. But he says the bottom line here as well, which is Torah is the same way. Even though Torah is so mifuaret, like wine, which is such a great drink, it has to be kept in earthenware utensils. So too, the Torah has to be kept in individuals or things like me. Someone who is ugly and not so beautiful, also the Torah is kept inside of an individual like me. Amrale, so she says back to him, Aika Shapirin, Vigmirin, aren't there beautiful people, good-looking, handsome individuals who also learn Torah? He responds to her, Yavusanu, have a Gemirin Tvei. If they were ugly, they would learn more. So now obviously, in terms of looks, it doesn't matter if an individual is handsome, it doesn't matter if a person is ugly, in terms of their ability to learn Torah and their ability to excel in Avodat Hashem. And Hashem doesn't care if a person's beautiful or handsome, or a person's ugly or not appealing in any way. They can both have the same capabilities in terms of learning Torah, being dedicated to Avodat Hashem. So what is meant by the response of Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya over here? The answer is, lies in the nature of those individuals. Someone who is handsome and good-looking, that in many ways causes the individual to pay more attention to those items that eats up the time of the individual and causes them to be dedicated to taking care of their good looks and attending to their beauty because they have it and they feel like they want to project it and show it to others. We find that by Yosef HaTzadik, the Midrash talks about Ayam Esalsel B'Saro. We find it by other individuals, Avshalom, people who are beautiful, spend time on working on their beauty and maintaining their beauty and their appearance. And so he says it's not an issue of their absolute objective beauty, handsomeness versus ugliness, but it has to do with what that does to the individual, what that causes the individual to do. So the more the person is worried about their looks and their appearance, the more time they have to dedicate it to it. And so he says about these good-looking people, if they were not having to maintain their beauty, then they had more time to dedicate to Torah, and they would have known even more. There was this woman who came before Rabbi Yehuda for a din. Rabbi Yehuda, who we know is the Talmud of Rav and Shmuel. And he paskin against her, he obligated her in the judgment. He says, as your Rebbe Shmuel also did the same thing and obligated me in this case. You know him? So that's one way to explain it, that the statement here by the woman is a statement of fact and not a question. And she's saying, your Rebbe Shmuel said the same thing. And now Rabbi Yehuda is saying, oh, you knew him? Then why were you asking me for the same thing if you already got a din from my Rebbe? The other way to read it, Rashi reads it as, Amrlei Shmuel Rabbi Chachi Danon? Would Shmuel your Rebbe have given the same psak halacha? And so Rabbi Yehuda says to him, you know my Rebbe? You know Shmuel? So Amrlei Yin, I did know him. Gutso. He was short, Rabba Krisei, and he had a huge belly. Ukum, he was of a dark complexion or a sunken complexion. Rabba Shine, and he had these big white teeth. You're coming to denigrate my Rebbe, to make fun of his appearance? She should be excommunicated, put into Shamto. Poko v'meita. She exploded or something untoward happened to her. Humeita, she died on the spot. And obviously for the kavod of Shmuel, how this connects to the other stories, either because of the difficult appearance of Shmuel, maybe this connects back to the story of Rabbi Shmuel ben Hananya, that Shmuel's appearance was not one that was so appealing, and nevertheless, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, corroborating maybe what was said by Rabbi Shmuel ben Hananya, or it might connect back to the story of Rabbi Akiva, where the Gemara is pointing out that the wealth of Rabbi Akiva came from other sources, not from his Talmidim. Over here, this woman is trying to denigrate Shmuel as being somebody who is preying on the people. He's getting fat and he's eats and loves food and utilizes his position in order to enrich himself. And Rabbi Yehuda, obviously in defense of Shmuel, says that's not the case and puts her into Shamto. Mutar bebeitza turmita. A person who takes a neder, a tafshil, mutar in this beitza turmuta, which the Gemara describes over here, my beitza turmita, what is this? That a servant who can make this beitza turmita is worth 1,000 dinarim. Meaning that this is such a unique type of skill that someone can make this, that he's worth a lot of money. The way that you make it is you put it into boiling hot water 1,000 times. And then 1,000 times in cold water. Until it basically shrivels up or shrinks. Keche de balita, that he's able to swallow it then in one shot. Vim it kiba srichala. And if the person has some problem inside of his intestines, his stomach, or some sort of illness, then it leaves a mark on this beitza tumita. Bechad nafka v'atyo, and after the person expels it from their body, you have to asya, my sama mitboile. Then the doctor knows what remedy that he needs. Saying what will bring cure to the ailment that he is suffering from. Shmuel have a bodik nafshe bekulcha. Shmuel used to check himself out. We know that Shmuel was involved in medicine or in cures for certain ailments. And Shmuel used to check himself with the kulcha. Here it's not clear what the kulcha is. The Tosafot suggests that this kulcha, I know beitza turmita, was it a beitza turmita itself? Others suggest, like Rashi, that it was a replacement for the beitza turmita, which he didn't have. He used to use this kulcha as a way to check himself out, to see what medicines he needed or what ailments were plaguing him. The Ranan says, used as a placement similar to what Rashi says, and you can see here in the Oroch that he says it's a kelach shel kruv, that he used to use a stalk of the cabbage in order to do this type of dika like the Beitza Tormita did. So he used to do this, ad mistarin inche beit alei sarion, until the people in his household used to pull their hair out. So Rashi says, he was weakened by eating this, and he used to pass out, until his wife was crying over losing him. She used to pull her out, worrying about what's happening to Shmuel. Tosafot says that, because of the pain or the difficulty of seeing Shmuel in this state, they used to pull their hair out. On the other hand, the Ran says over here, that similar to Rashi, that he used to pass out from this. They didn't literally pull out their hair, but they undid their braids in their hair. They let their hair down because of the difficulty of facing what was happening to Shmuel. They couldn't believe what was going on. Tananatam, we have a mission over there. If you have a worker who's working with this type of pig species called a klufsin, he's not allowed to then partake of another species of fig called the Benot Sheva. If he's working with Benot Sheva, lo yochal beklopsin. If he's working with the Benot Sheva, he shouldn't be eating the klopsin. It's based on the din that's brought in the Torah in Sefer Devarim, that the worker in the field, when he's working with fruits that are in the field, that are in their finished state, then he's allowed to partake of those fruits when he's picking them. So here it says, even though these are both te'anim, and they're just different species of te'anim, if he's working with one species, then he doesn't have the right then to take the other species and eat it because he is working with the specific species, and that limits his ability to take from that which he's working with, even to the point where the same fruit, but different species of the fruit, he's only permitted to take that which he's working with, not something else. My klufsin. What are these klufsin? Mine de te'ine da'avin minhon lifte. It is a type of fig from which they make this lifte, which was some sort of dish or cooked dish that they made from these te'inim, or items that were accompaniment to be put together with the bread. There's this individual who gave his eved, or sold his eved, to give this individual, teach him 1,000 different methods of making lifte, or 1,000 different types of lifte. Agmere tamne meya. He taught him 800. He got up to 800 different types that he taught him. Zamna ledino, the kamei de rabbi. He invited the guy to a Beit Din, to a Din Torah in front of Rabbi, because he had promised him 1,000 and he had paid him to get 1,000, and now he's only getting 800. Amar Rabbi, Abotenu Amru, Nashinu Tova. Our forefathers said that we forgot all the good. I mean, that we knew about the good and then we forgot about it. Anu Afilu Beinenu Loraino. We never even knew the good to forget about it. Here, this guy gave you 800 different things. We don't even know about these things, and you're complaining? Now, whether Rabbi was saying that 1,000 is not literally 1,000, 1,000 just means a lot, and 800 qualifies as 1,000, or the Rabbi saying to him that 800 is enough, meaning that, and nobody knows this many different types of recipes or goodness in the world, that's all been forgotten, meaning that our forefathers forgot it, and but they had seen it. We didn't even see stuff. We don't even have a semblance of what they saw, and this 800 is an extreme number, and that should be satisfying to you, and that you should be happy with 800, even though he didn't get to the 1,000, and therefore you're not entitled to compensation for the fact that he didn't get to the 1,000. Rabbi Avadlehi Lulo, the Rabbi Shimon Barabi, or the Rabbi Shimon Bray, obviously Rabbi Shimon Barabi is Rabbi's son, Rabbi Shimon. So he made a wedding for his son, Rabbi Shimon. Katava Beganana, somebody wrote on the chuppah, Esrim Ve'arba Alfin Ribuan, 24,000, 10,000 of dinarim, Nafku Beit Ganana Dain. Did they expend on this chuppah, meaning on this party? Lo zamne the bar kaporo. And they didn't invite bar kaporo. Amarle. So then bar kaporo offers, im lo vrei ritzono kach. If this is what he does for people who don't listen to him, lo se ritzono akat kama kama. For those that do listen to a Kodesh Baruch Hu al kat kama vakama. So now whether Rabbi bar kaporo was poking at Rabbi, saying that, you know, Rabbi, it's not right that you didn't invite me to the su'uda. And therefore, if this is what Hashem does for those that are not in tune with Hashem because you're not inviting me, then certainly for those that are in tune with Hashem, then certainly they will be rewarded. Or the reason that Rabbi did not invite Bar Kapara to the party was because of the problem of the Churban, that a person is not allowed to have a full Simcha. and therefore he left people out, especially Bar Kapara. I see in a minute why that he would leave out Bar Kapara, but because of that, Bar Kapara is upset, and he says, if Hashem takes care of those that don't keep the word of Hashem, meaning that they don't invite everyone, and he thought it was incorrect that Rabbi was holding back from inviting people in order to minimize the simcha, because he held like the shito to believe that one has to do minimal amounts of zeich l'churban, but not full types of zeich l'churban where you don't invite people. And therefore, he was wrong in doing that. And therefore, he says, based on that, people do listen and do real full parties, then Hashem will reward them even greater way. Or that he was referencing to the churban of Eid itself, which is, look at all the non-Jews who contributed to the churban and how much they celebrate. And certainly in Atid Lavo, there will be a great celebration for people like us who keep the word of Hashem. Azamne. In the end, the Rabbi invites Bar Kapara. Amar, he changes his line or his way. Amar, this is what he does to those that follow the ways of Hashem in this world. Olam Haba, Lachad Kama V'Kama. And certainly in Olam Haba. So obviously the invitation of Rabbi to Bar Kapara changed his mind about how he viewed the wealth or the spending on the party of Rabbi. Now the reason that Rabbi did not invite Bar Kapara, Rashi says it's based on the Gemara that's upcoming. And Rashi says it's Lefishaya Ish Batchan. He was a comic, and he used to make people laugh, and he felt that laughter and jokes were a good thing. And Rabbi was afraid that Bar Kapara would make him laugh. And based on the next Gemara, we'll see why Rabbi didn't want to laugh, and that's why he didn't invite him to the party at first, but later on relents and invites him to the party. The other possibility is that the upcoming stories are also where Bar Kapara doesn't treat Rabbi with proper kavod. So the household of Rabbi felt it was inappropriate to invite Bar Kapara to the Simcha, but again, later Rabbi relents and invites Bar Kapara to the Simcha. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of Nun Amud Bet.